Chapter 37 Continued. Dumbledore stared for a moment at the sunlit grounds outside the window, then looked back at Harry and said, 5 years ago you arrived at Hogwarts, Harry, safe and whole, as I had planned and intended. Well, not quite whole. You had suffered. I knew you would when I left you on your aunt and uncle's doorstep. I knew I was condemning you to 10 dark and difficult years. He paused. Harry said nothing. You might ask, and with good reason, why it had to be so. Why could some wizarding family not have taken you in? Many would have done so more than gladly, would have been honoured and delighted to raise you as a son. My answer is that my priority was to keep you alive. You were in more danger than perhaps anyone but I realized. Voldemort had been vanquished hours before, but his supporters, and many of them are almost as terrible as he, were still at large, angry, desperate, and violent. And I had to make my decision, too, with regard to the years ahead. Did I believe that Voldemort was gone for ever? No. I knew not whether it would be 10, 20, or 50 years before he returned, but I was sure he would do so. And I was sure, too, knowing him as I have done, that he would not rest until he killed you. I knew that Voldemort's knowledge of magic is perhaps more extensive than any wizard alive. I knew that even my most complex and powerful protective spells and charms were unlikely to be invincible if he ever returned to full power. But I knew, too, where Voldemort was weak. And so I made my decision. You would be protected by an ancient magic of which he knows, which he despises, and which he has always, therefore, underestimated to his cost. I am speaking, of course, of the fact that your mother died to save you. She gave you a lingering protection he never expected, a protection that flows in your veins to this day. I put my trust, therefore, in your mother's blood. I delivered you to her sister, her only remaining relative. "She doesn't love me," said Harry at once. "She doesn't give a damn." "But she took you," Dumbledore cut across him. "She may have taken you grudgingly, furiously, unwillingly, bitterly, yet still she took you. And in doing so, she sealed the charm I placed upon you. Your mother's sacrifice made the bond of blood the strongest shield I could give you."
"I still don't—"
"While you can still call home the place where your mother's blood dwells, there you cannot be touched or harmed by Voldemort. He shed her blood, but it lives on in you and her sister. Her blood became your refuge. You need return there only once a year, but as long as you can still call it home, whilst you are there, he cannot hurt you." "Your aunt knows this. I explained what I had done in the letter I left with you on her doorstep. She knows that allowing you house room may well have kept you alive for the past 15 years.
"Wait," said Harry. "Wait a moment."
He sat up straighter in his chair, staring at Dumbledore.
"You sent that howler. You told her to remember. It was your voice."
"I thought," said Dumbledore, inclining his head slightly, "that she might need reminding of the pact she had sealed by taking you. I suspected the Dementor attack might have awoken her to the dangers of having you as a surrogate son."
"It did," said Harry quietly. "Well, my uncle more than her. He wanted to chuck me out, but after the howler came, she said I had to stay."
He stared at the floor for a moment, then said, "But what's this got to do with—" He could not say Sirius's name. 5 years ago, then," continued Dumbledore, as though he had not paused in his story, "you arrived at Hogwarts, neither as happy nor as well-nourished as I would have liked, perhaps, yet alive and healthy. You were not a pampered little prince, but as normal a boy as I could have hoped under the circumstances. Thus far, my plan was working well. And then, well,
you will remember the events of your first year at Hogwarts quite as clearly as I do. You rose magnificently to the challenge that faced you, and sooner, much sooner than I had anticipated, you found yourself face to face with Voldemort. You survived again. You did more. You delayed his return to full power and strength. You fought a man's fight. I was prouder of you than I can say. Yet there was a flaw in this wonderful plan of mine, said Dumbledore. An obvious flaw that I knew even then might be the undoing of it all. And yet, knowing how important it was that my plan should succeed, I told myself that I would not permit this flaw to ruin it. I alone could prevent this, so I alone must be strong. And here was my first test, as you lay in the hospital wing, weak from your struggle with Voldemort.
"I don't understand what you're saying," said Harry.
"Don't you remember asking me, as you lay in the hospital wing, why Voldemort had tried to kill you when you were a baby?" Harry nodded. "Ought I to have told you then?" Harry stared into the blue eyes and said nothing, but his heart was racing again. "You do not see the flaw in the plan yet?" "No, perhaps not. Well, as you know, I decided not to answer you. 11, I told myself, was much too young to know. I had never intended to tell you when you were 11. The knowledge would be too much at such a young age. I should have recognized the danger signs then. I should have asked myself why I did not feel more disturbed that you had already asked me the question to which I knew one day I must give a terrible answer. I should have recognized that I was too happy to think that I did not have to do it on that particular day. You were too young, much too young. And so we entered your second year at Hogwarts. And once again you met challenges even grown wizards have never faced. Once again you acquitted yourself beyond my wildest dreams. You did not ask me again, however, why Voldemort had left that mark on you. We discussed your scar. Oh, yes, we came very, very close to the subject. Why did I not tell you everything? Well, it seemed to me that 12 was, after all, hardly better than 11 to receive such information. I allowed you to leave my presence, bloodstained, exhausted, but exhilarated, and if I felt a twinge of unease that I ought perhaps to have told you then, it was swiftly silenced. You were still so young, you see, and I could not find it in myself to spoil that night of triumph. Do you see, Harry? Do you see the flaw in my brilliant plan now? I had fallen into the trap I had foreseen, that I had told myself I could avoid, that I must avoid. I cared about you too much, said Dumbledore simply. I cared more for your happiness than your knowing the truth, more for your peace of mind than my plan, more for your life than the lives that might be lost if the plan failed. In other words, I acted exactly as Voldemort expects we fools who love to act. Is there a defense? I defy anyone who has watched you as I have, and I have watched you more closely than you can have imagined, not to want to save you more pain than you had already suffered. What did I care if numbers of nameless and faceless people and creatures were slaughtered in the vague future, if in the here and now you were alive and well and happy? I never dreamed that I would have such a person on my hands. We entered your third year. I watched from afar as you struggled to repel Dementors, as you found Sirius, learned what he was, and rescued him. Was I to tell you then, at the moment when you had triumphantly snatched your godfather from the jaws of the Ministry? But now, at the age of 13, my excuses were running out. Young you might be, but you had proved you were exceptional. My conscience was uneasy, Harry. I knew the time must come soon. But you came out of the maze last year having watched Cedric Diggory die, having escaped death so narrowly yourself. And I did not tell you, though I knew, now Voldemort had returned, I must do it soon. And now tonight, I know you have long been ready for the knowledge I have kept from you for so long, because you have proved that I should have placed the burden upon you before this. My only defence is this. I have watched you struggling under more burdens than any student who has ever passed through this school, and I could not bring myself to add another, the greatest one of all.
Harry waited, but Dumbledore did not speak.
I still don't understand.
Voldemort tried to kill you when you were a child, because of a prophecy made shortly before your birth. He knew the prophecy had been made, though he did not know its full contents. He set out to kill you when you were still a baby, believing he was fulfilling the terms of the prophecy. He discovered, to his cost, that he was mistaken when the curse intended to kill you backfired. And so, since his return to his body, and particularly since your extraordinary escape from him last year, he has been determined to hear that prophecy in its entirety. This is the weapon he has been seeking so assiduously since his return, the knowledge of how to destroy you. The sun had risen fully now. Dumbledore's office was bathed in it. The glass case in which the sword of Godric Gryffindor resided gleamed white and opaque. The fragments of the instruments Harry had thrown to the floor glistened like raindrops, and behind him the baby Fawkes made soft, chirruping noises in his nest of ashes.
"The prophecy's smashed," Harry said blankly. "I was pulling Neville up those benches in the room where the archway was, and I ripped his robes and it fell."
The thing that smashed was merely the record of the prophecy kept by the Department of Mysteries. But the prophecy was made to somebody, and that person has the means of recalling it perfectly.
"Who heard it?"
asked Harry, though he thought he knew the answer already.
"I did," said Dumbledore. "On a cold, wet night, 16 years ago, in a room above the bar at the Hogshead Inn. I had gone there to see an applicant for the post of divination teacher, though it was against my inclination to allow the subject of divination to continue at all. The applicant, however, was the great-great-granddaughter of a very famous, very gifted seer, and I thought it common politeness to meet her. I was disappointed. It seemed to me that she had not a trace of the gift herself. I told her, courteously, I hope, that I did not think she would be suitable for the post. I turned to leave."
Dumbledore got to his feet and walked past Harry to the black cabinet that stood beside Fawkes's perch. He bent down, slid back a catch, and took from inside it the shallow stone basin carved with runes around the edges in which Harry had seen his father tormenting Snape. Dumbledore walked back to the desk, placed the pensieve upon it, and raised his wand to his own temple. From it he withdrew silvery, gossamer-fine strands of thought clinging to the wand, and deposited them into the basin. He sat back down behind his desk, and watched his thoughts swirl and drift inside the pensieve for a moment. Then, with a sigh, he raised his wand and prodded the silvery substance with its tip. A figure rose out of it, draped in shawls. Her eyes magnified to enormous size behind her glasses, and she revolved slowly, her feet in the basin. But when Sybil Trelawney spoke, it was not in her usual ethereal, mystic voice, but in the harsh, hoarse tones Harry had heard her use once before.
"The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord approaches. Born to those who have thrice defied him, born as the seventh month dies, and the Dark Lord will mark him as his equal, but he will have power the Dark Lord knows not, and either must die at the hand of the other, for neither can live while the other survives. The one with the power to vanquish the Dark Lord will be born as the seventh month dies."
The slowly revolving Professor Trelawney sank back into the silver mass below and vanished. The silence within the office was absolute. Neither Dumbledore nor Harry nor any of the portraits made a sound. Even Fawkes had fallen silent. "Professor Dumbledore," Harry said very quietly, for Dumbledore, still staring at the pensive, seemed completely lost in thought.
"Did that mean... what did that mean?"
"It meant," said Dumbledore, "that the person who has the only chance of conquering Lord Voldemort for good was born at the end of July, nearly 16 years ago. This boy would be born to parents who had already defied Voldemort 3 times. Harry felt as though something was closing in on him. His breathing seemed difficult again.
"It means me."
"The odd thing, Harry," he said softly, "is that it may not have meant you at all. Sibyl's prophecy could have applied to 2 wizard boys, both born at the end of July that year, both of whom had parents in the Order of the Phoenix, both sets of parents having narrowly escaped Voldemort 3 times. One, of course, was you. The other was Neville Longbottom."
But then why was it my name on the prophecy and not Neville's?"
"The official record was relabeled after Voldemort's attack on you as a child," said Dumbledore. "It seemed plain to the Keeper of the Hall of Prophecy that Voldemort could only have tried to kill you because he knew you to be the one to whom Sibyl was referring."
"Then it might not be me," said Harry.
"I am afraid," said Dumbledore slowly, looking as though every word cost him a great effort, "that there is no doubt that it is you."
"But you said Neville was born at the end of July too, and his mum and dad—"
"You are forgetting the next part of the prophecy, the final identifying feature of the boy who could vanquish Voldemort. Voldemort himself would mark him as his equal." "And so he did, Harry. He chose you, not Neville. He gave you the scar that has proved both blessing and curse."
"But he might have chosen wrong," said Harry. "He might have marked the wrong person."
"He chose the boy he thought most likely to be a danger to him," said Dumbledore. "And notice this, Harry. He chose not the pure blood, which according to his creed is the only kind of wizard worth being or knowing, but the half-blood, like himself. He saw himself in you before he had ever seen you. And in marking you with that scar, he did not kill you, as he intended, but gave you powers and a future, which have fitted you to escape him not once, but 4 times so far, something that neither your parents nor Neville's parents ever achieved."
"Why did he do it, then?" said Harry, who felt numb and cold. "Why did he try and kill me as a baby? He should have waited to see whether Neville or I looked more dangerous when we were older, and tried to kill whoever it was then."
"That might indeed have been the more practical course," said Dumbledore, "except that Voldemort's information about the prophecy was incomplete. The Hogshead Inn, which Sibyl chose for its cheapness, has long attracted, shall we say, a more interesting clientele than the 3 Broomsticks. As you and your friends found out to your cost, and I to mine that night, it is a place where it is never safe to assume you are not being overheard. Of course, I had not dreamed, when I set out to meet Sibyl Trelawney, that I would hear anything worth overhearing. One stroke of good fortune was that the eavesdropper was detected only a short way into the prophecy and thrown from the building. So he only heard the beginning, the part foretelling the birth of a boy in July to parents who had thrice defied Voldemort.
Consequently, he could not warn his master that to attack you would be to risk transferring power to you and marking you as his equal. So Voldemort never knew that there might be danger in attacking you, that it might be wise to wait to learn more. He did not know that you would have power the Dark Lord knows not.
"But I don't," said Harry in a strangled voice. "I haven't any powers he hasn't got. I couldn't fight the way he did tonight. I can't possess people or kill them."
"There is a room in the Department of Mysteries," interrupted Dumbledore, "that is kept locked at all times. It contains a force that is at once more wonderful and more terrible than death, than human intelligence, than the forces of nature. It is also, perhaps, the most mysterious of the many subjects for study that reside there. It is the power held within that room that you possess in such quantities, and which Voldemort has not at all. That power took you to save Sirius tonight. That power also saved you from possession by Voldemort, because he could not bear to reside in a body so full of the force he detests. In the end, it mattered not that you could not close your mind. It was your heart that saved you." Harry closed his eyes. If he had not gone to save Sirius, Sirius would not have died. More to stave off the moment when he would have to think of Sirius again, Harry asked, without caring much about the answer, "The end of the prophecy, it was something about neither can live while the other survives," said Dumbledore. "So," said Harry, dredging up the words from what felt like a deep well of despair inside him, "so does that mean that one of us has got to kill the other one, in the end?" "Yes," said Dumbledore. For a long time, neither of them spoke. Somewhere far beyond the office walls, Harry could hear the sound of voices, students heading down to the great hall for an early breakfast, perhaps. It seemed impossible that there could be people in the world who still desired food, who laughed, who neither knew nor cared that Sirius Black was gone for ever. Sirius seemed a million miles away already. Even now, a part of Harry still believed that if he had only pulled back that veil, he would have found Sirius looking back at him, greeting him, perhaps, with his laugh like a bark.
"'I feel I owe you another explanation, Harry,' said Dumbledore hesitantly. "'You may perhaps have wondered why I never chose you as a prefect. "'I must confess that I rather thought you had enough responsibility to be going on with.'
Harry looked up at him and saw a tear trickling down Dumbledore's face into his long silver beard.